Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I want to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. It's a beautiful evening. We're so glad that you could join us despite the wonderful weather that you could be distracted by. As you know, we hold programs like this on a regular basis. They might be debates or seminars or panel discussions or lectures at our conference center here in Oakland. Our program this evening is entitled Bureaucracy versus the Environment. What should be done? And this evening, we're particularly pleased to feature the new book, Rethinking Green, which is a book that we publish here at the Institute. And I'll have more to say about that in a minute. For those of you who are new to the Institute, hopefully you all got a packet of information about our program. The Institute is a nonprofit academic public policy research institute. We sponsor studies by different scholars on major issues. We have about 140 research fellows currently who are involved in different projects. You're welcome to visit our website, which is at independent.org, and you'll find a wealth of information on environmental issues and virtually every other issue imaginable. We also publish many books in addition to the one we're featuring this evening, and you're welcome to get information. There's a catalog in your packet that you're welcome to ask us questions about. We also publish a journal called the Independent Review, which is quarterly, and there are copies upstairs. You're welcome to sample, and I think you'll find that quite interesting. I also want to point out another one of our books, which you'll find in the catalog, which is called The Poverty of Reason. It's a look at the issues of sustainable development, economic growth, the precautionary principle, and all of that also relates to this evening's topic. Incidentally, for those of you who are not aware, we also produce a weekly email newsletter called The Lighthouse, and that's complimentary for anyone who wants to receive it. If you do want to receive it, just go to our homepage and you can subscribe or leave us your email address. We'd be happy to send that to you. Environmental quality has been, as you all know, a major public concern, certainly since the first Earth Day in 1970, but of course the issue goes far further back than that. An increasing number of people have become concerned about sort of a maze of environmental bureaucracies that exist, which inhibit decision-making and flexibility to deal with complex ecosystems and the rights of people and legal disputes and many other things. One of the questions is, what can these failures or problems teach us about how best to deal with the realities of environmental issues? How can entrepreneurship, how can individuals be effective in fostering ways to deal with issues like endangered species or sensitive habitat or land use issues of all sorts and so forth? For example, the June 11th issue of the San Francisco Chronicle reported how governments have created millions of conservation refugees worldwide through various wildlife preserves. This is particularly notable, as the article pointed out, in Africa. They're creating these wildlife preserves while essentially destroying the lives of the people who live there. In other words, in the name of protecting the environment for these people, they're actually destroying the lives. Here's a quote from the journal. Quote, "Younger enlightened conservationists are now willing to admit that wrecking the lives of 10 million or more poor, powerless people has been an enormous mistake. Not only a moral, social, philosophical, and economic mistake, but an ecological one as well. They've learned from bitter experience that national parks and protected areas surrounded by angry, hungry people who describe themselves as, quote, enemies of conservation are generally doomed to fail," unquote. So the lesson here that good intentions are not enough is clear, and this certainly applies to environmental issues. So instead of bureaucracy and interest group politics, various economists and others have been looking for a while now toward incentives and what's called economically or market-based approaches to environmental issues, to create positive incentives, fostering conservation, and at the same time protecting the rights of people to advance themselves. So to address these issues, we're very pleased to have three really excellent speakers, extremely knowledgeable on these issues. Our first speaker is Carl Close, who is the co-editor of Rethinking Green. Carl is the academic affairs director here at the Independent Institute. He's also the assistant editor of our journal, The Independent Review, and editor of The Lighthouse, the weekly email newsletter I mentioned. He's also co-editor of another one of our new books, which is called The Challenge of Liberty, which you can also see information in your catalog. Carl received his BA in economics from San Francisco State University and his MA in economics from the University of California at Santa Barbara, where he also taught economics. So, Carl.
Thank you, David. It's my first time on this side of the microphone. I'm usually the person over there. You see me running around, handing the microphone around. So tonight I get to pontificate instead of learn. Now, like many of you, I grew up with Earth Day, which was recognized every April in my schools. I remember attending a grammar school that had rallies where traveling troubadours would sing songs about preserving the environment. They'd perform funny skits about why you shouldn't mess around with Mother Nature. And they would get hundreds of us shouting at the top of our lungs very simple but clever slogans that stuck, like, "Give a hoot, don't pollute." On the big trash day each year, we could volunteer to decide which part of the school grounds we could clean up, pick up abandoned newspapers, candy wrappers, and other unsightly litter that had accumulated along the fence surrounding the school in a very windy hometown. I loved playing in the huge gully near my house, a hillside labyrinth made of sandstone and filled with bushes and thistles that stuck to my navy blue sweater and white socks. You couldn't explore it all in one afternoon. It was huge. It was my Grand Canyon. It was wild with garter snakes, jackrabbits, and no adults around. It was my Garden of Eden. So I was tremendously saddened when it was terraced to make way for new housing. And here they were, removing me from my Garden of Eden, even though I hadn't so much as taken a bite from any forbidden fruit, and the only snake I'd talked to was probably one behind a glass wall at the Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park. Now, years later, I visited a more significant Garden of Eden with my dad, the Galapagos Islands, where I got to see all kinds of fantastic wildlife. Blue-footed boobies. Now, those are birds. It's not a girl group on MTV. Huge tortoises, older than Phyllis Diller, and probably more wrinkled. Marine iguanas spewing salt water out of their heads. Different kinds of finches, each with a uniquely shaped beak that made it better at getting a certain kind of food than other finches. I even had the amazing experience of having a sea lion swim around me while I was snorkeling. But all was not well in paradise. On one of the islands where there were non-tourists living year-round, I saw some boys taunt a donkey and trip it. The donkey fell, squealed, and the boys laughed, and my blood boiled. Much later in life, I scolded a cop for throwing a cigarette butt out of his car window. That probably wasn't exactly sustainable behavior on my part. Old habits die hard. Even today, if I go hiking with friends, Bill knows this, I don't like it when someone even throws a biodegradable apple core or banana peel on the trail. Better to throw it out of sight, then let it biodegrade. Give a hoot, don't pollute. So I guess I was a child of Earth Day, not the most zealous of its celebrants, but one comfortable with at least some of its rituals. So you can imagine my surprise when, a few weeks ago, I got a call from the founder of Earth Day, Mr. John McConnell. He'd seen our book catalog and said he's very interested in our work. So I told him about our earlier book, edited or written by Wilfred Beckerman. It's called The Poverty of Reason. economic sustainable development and economic growth, and Rethinking Green. And I asked John for a story. Now, John's seen a lot. He's 91 years old. In 1939, while managing a plastics manufacturing facility, he started thinking about developing a plastic using walnut shells. And then he started looking into other new uses for waste products, and his interest in ecology grew. He was also interested in promoting peace and justice along with the care of the earth. And he got involved with all kinds of organizations to promote his vision. And I asked him, what was the biggest change he'd seen with respect to the environment? And he told me that he thought, as a consequence of Earth Day, people seem much more motivated to learn how to help the environment. Now, I can't argue with that, but at the same time, a lot of people believe that awareness hasn't translated into exceptionally effective, efficient, or equitable environmental policies. A March 2006 Gallup poll asked, right now, do you think the quality of the environment in the country as a whole is getting better or getting worse? 25% said getting better. 67% said getting worse. Now, it's easy to put too much credence in those results for any number of reasons. One is that in response to another Gallup poll question the year before, question was, would you say you are optimistic or pessimistic that we have that we'll be able to solve or make good progress on our environmental problems in the next 20 years? 54% were optimists, 43% were pessimists. So the people in the poll were short-term pessimists and long-term optimists. In addition, some of the more easily measured outcomes, such as air quality, we've seen significant improvements over the last three or four decades, although such progress isn't necessarily reflected in public opinion polls. Now, I wonder how someone like John McConnell would explain something like that. Earth Day has raised the public's awareness of the environment, but the same public thinks that that awareness hasn't translated particularly well into public policy. Also, I'd ask, if those poll results suggest that the public will push for more attention being paid to environmental policy, and if so, exactly what would that portend? Should we have more of the same types of policies, with more enforcement perhaps? Or do we need to rethink our approach to environmental policy? I think if you know the title of my book, you have a clue what I would favor. Now, you've heard that one definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting to get different results. With that in mind, here's some arguments for rethinking our environmental policies. Now, I'll start off with some criticisms that come from people or groups that you might expect to be critical of our current environmental approach. For example, small business owners who disproportionately bear the brunt of our environmental regulations. In an analysis submitted by the Small Business Administration's Office of Advocacy to a congressional hearing last year, economist Mark Crane found that in 2004, compliance with EPA regulations on average costs small manufacturers, that is those with 20 or fewer employees, a whopping $15,747 per worker. And that's compared to $3,391 per worker for large manufacturers, those with 500 or more employees. Now, is the Small Business Administration blowing smoke? In response to these types of criticisms, the EPA last year announced that it would implement 42 regulatory reforms to help reduce compliance costs. Now, another group you might expect to be dissatisfied with many of our environmental policies might be workers. In a study published in the 1995 issue of the Yale Journal of Regulation, economist James Robinson, now currently with UC Berkeley School of Public Health, found that environmental regulations had accounted for much of the slowdown of U.S. manufacturing productivity growth between 1974 and 1986. What economists call multi-factor productivity, which is the efficiency of labor, machinery, and other inputs working together, had by 1986 fallen by about 11.4% short of where it would have been had there not been the EPA regulations. And this, he says, apparently contributed to a 3-decade-long decline in real weekly wages. That is, what workers took home in inflation-adjusted dollars. And that occurred up until the computer industry boom that took place, that began in the 1990s, which helped raise productivity across the board, but particularly in industries most closely tied to information technology. Now, those are the kinds of criticisms you might expect to hear, right? Criticisms that maybe an economist might find interesting to investigate. We've all heard that accountants and economists are supposedly foolish enough to know the price of everything and the value of nothing. But some of you might say, well, what matters isn't so much the cost of our environmental policies. Everything has a cost. It's that those costs are necessary if we want clean air, clean water, vibrant ecosystems with abundant biodiversity, and other environmental amenities that support both a healthy human population and a healthy planet. So, let's consider some of the criticisms of our environmental policies and environmental thinking in general by some individuals who are more closely identified with the environmental movement. For example, Patrick Moore, who helped found Greenpeace in 1971, has some very interesting things to say about the environmental movement that he helped shape. In its early years, Greenpeace, Moore said, has lots of praise for it. He said, "We sail the seas saving whales, protesting nuclear testing and nuclear dumping, halting supertankers, saving baby seals, preventing toxic waste discharge, and interfering with net drifts." These were heady times for countless moments. These were heady times with countless moments of excitement, danger, frustration, and victory. Looking back, it's hard to believe we accomplished so much as we raised public awareness about all things environmental. Now, among other adventures or misadventures, you might remember that Greenpeace in 1985, their first Rainbow Warrior ship, they had other ships later on with the same name, was sunk by French commandos in a New Zealand harbor, resulting in the accidental death of photographer Fernando Pereira. Moore left Greenpeace a year later, stating his increasing discomfort with Greenpeace's increasingly confrontational tactics, as he himself came to favor the politics of consensus. Moore continues, "Little did I realize at the time how this would bring me into open and direct conflict with the movement I'd helped bring into the world. I now find that many environmental groups have drifted into self-serving cliques of narrow vision and rigid ideology. At the same time that business and government are embracing public participation and inclusiveness, many environmentalists are showing signs of elitism, left-wingism, and downright eco-fascism. The once politically centrist, science-based vision of environmentalism has been largely replaced with extremist rhetoric. Science and logic have been abandoned, and the movement is often used to promote causes such as class struggle and anti-corporatism. The public is left trying to figure out what is reasonable and what is not." Now, some activists call Patrick Moore a sellout. But rather than rush to judgment, let's consider another criticism of environmental thinking, contemporary environmental thinking, or more specifically, environmental policy. This comes from New York law professor David Schoenbrod, one of the co-founders co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Schoenbrod was with NRDC from its inception, and in his first case with the NRDC, he sued the EPA for, quote, failing to protect young children from gasoline and lead. The agency, he explains in his book, Saving Our Environment from Washington, was politically at risk from the get-go. What he does is paint a picture of the EPA as Congress's easy way out. Congress created the EPA in part to assuage pressures from Detroit. From 1963 to 1968, the number of states with air pollution laws went from 16 to 46. This I'm quoting Schoenbrod again. The burdens imposed varied greatly and were small by modern standards, but they were enough to prompt the auto industry and then the coal mining industry to try to check the state and local responses to grassroots demand. The solution they hit upon was to get Congress to amend the Clean Air Act to put a national agency in charge of making air pollution laws. The members deliberated. President Nixon established the EPA. By the end of the year, the 1970 Clean Air Act endowed it with sweeping new powers to make law. It was a prototype for many subsequent statutes dealing with other kinds of pollution. Through the 1970s, the air pollution laws the EPA made accomplished less than the laws that came directly from Congress, states, and localities. Today, the air is much cleaner than it was in 1970, and the EPA deserves some of the credit, but it's simply wrong to think that the EPA imposed environmental protection on a reluctant public. He continues, major corporations today understand that the EPA provides them with substantial benefits. Its lawmaking is necessarily slow because of procedural requirements imposed by Congress and the courts. The EPA also buffers large corporations from competition from small and emerging businesses. The regulations are expensive for too large corporations, but they can be passed on to consumers. So, David Schoenbrod and Patrick Moore, both very deep in the environmental movement, have described two kinds of groups that benefit from environmental bureaucracy, or groups that think that they benefit most from the current setup. The ideologically driven and the materially driven. Not that there's anything wrong with those motivations necessarily. And Schoenbrod's and Moore's analysis is complemented by those in our book, Rethinking Green. The book, by the way, is a collection of articles from the Independent Review, their quarterly journal. It represents the best of the environmental articles from the first 8 or 9 years of the journal's existence. Most of the articles are written by economists, but don't let that keep you from reading it. Our aim in the Independent Review is to publish readable scholarship. Okay. In addition to economists, I should add, we also have chapters written by legal scholars, political scientists such as Randy Simmons and Robert Nelson. There's a professor of geography. Law school professor Andrew Morse, brilliant analyst, former member of the British Parliament, the late Peter Bauer, who's also an economist and a civil servant in Western Africa, where he first got his insights that made him such a unique voice in the field of development economics. And there's even, in Rethinking Green, a professor of philosophy, Lauren Lomasky. So it's filled not with just economists, though. Not that there's necessarily anything wrong with those kinds of books. Now, in Rethinking Green, we present three basic problems with a wide variety of environmental policies. Let me give you some examples of those and then discuss very briefly their origins and show how they add up to ways that elucidate the observations and experience of Patrick Moore and David Schoenbrod. A lot of the details are going to be provided later on tonight from Randy Simmons and Michael Shaw. Now, three main problems. These have to do with inefficiency, ineffectiveness, and invasiveness. First, many of our policies are inefficient and they use a lot of resources. I mentioned earlier that one economist argued that the federal command and control environmental regulations have contributed to a slowdown in economic growth. That sort of analysis is extended in Chapter 2, written by Craig Markson at the University of Nebraska. What he does is put this into a wider context. He looks at the development of environmental thought leading up to the EPA and then through the 1970s, the big surge of environmental policy. And what he notes is that a lot of the policies were motivated by the fears associated with books like The Limits to Growth, 1972, published by the Club of Rome. It looked very sophisticated, lots of computer analyses in the appendix that argued very extreme predictions. We'd run out of natural resources in 20 years. We'll be choking in pollution. We'll all die. We'll certainly have an economic depression. So unless we implement federal command and control policies, our economy is going to suffer, and our lives and health as well. Well, as Markson points out, there's a big irony here, and that is that the policies that motivated led to a slowdown in economic growth. Now, here's another unintended irony, which is that when the economy drags, people start to worry more about jobs than they do about the environment. So too many expensive environmental regulations can be completely counterproductive to promoting environmental ends. Another example is the Superfund program. This was created partly in response to Love Canal to clean up hazardous waste sites throughout the country. And numerous sites were identified. More than $10 billion was spent. But little heed was given to whether those sites actually posed real health risks to people. A lot of lawyers did well, but that $10 billion would have gone a long way toward addressing more tangible risks, such as highway safety. So that's the first criticism, that our environmental policies are often inefficient. Second, many environmental regulations are ineffective. They don't work as advertised. Some are outright counterproductive. One example comes from Chapter 15 in the book by Randall O'Toole, where he discusses so-called smart growth urban planning. Smart growth policies try to make communities more livable and less stressful on the environment by reducing sprawl and increasing urban density, reducing our need to use cars or to live in suburbs. Now, a lot of these policies sound very appealing to those of us who like vibrant urban areas with lots of mixed-use neighborhoods, with attractive areas to walk or bicycle, and reliable transit systems. Unfortunately, good intentions don't guarantee good results. In Portland, Oregon, for example, city planners were attempting to increase the city's population by 75% and adding 120 miles of rail transit. But population growth of that magnitude, Toole points out, would overwhelm any reduction in the rate of automobile usage, causing, in his estimate, three times more traffic congestion and slower travel times and more air quality problems than they have now. Rail transit projects typically cost $50 million per mile, but that amount of money could build 2.5 miles of four-lane freeway, which has greater carrying capacity than rail transit. Now, the third basic problem we describe in Rethinking Green is that many of our environmental policies are very invasive. I think that's sort of the differentia of our book, especially the influence of Robert Higgs throughout the editorial process, throughout 10 years of editing that went into the book. Now, Superfund is certainly one example. But in Chapter 17 of the book, Bruce Yandel and Andrew Morris discuss a new strategy by the EPA. It's called regulation by litigation. And they show how this allowed the agency to extort, well, that's the word some people would, maybe that's too pointed a term, to extract, maybe that's more neutral, $1 billion settlement from an industry that by its nature wouldn't seem terribly appealing to many. Yet it's one we all use, if only indirectly. And that is the heavy-duty diesel engine industry. The EPA had told representatives of the industry that if they use a certain electronic control device on their engines, they'll be able to meet urban emission standards. And industry complied. Now, you'd think that would get you off the hook if you were working in this industry. But what engine manufacturers did was design engines that met that standard and also focused on getting good mileage on the highway. Then the EPA went back to them and claimed that they hadn't done anything to meet the same emission standards for the highway. Industry said, "You didn't tell us we had to meet highway emission standards. We followed your guidelines and used your approved device and met urban emission standards. Now we've got to meet some other standard you didn't specify earlier." But the EPA had the resources to drag this out in court and eventually came up with a settlement. Now, before there was regulation by litigation, we had traditional regulation by rulemaking and regulation by negotiation. And the process was very transparent. There was a modicum of certainty for industry and for those who favored stricter standards. The transparency of the regulatory process allowed it to be better monitored by the legislative and the executive branches. Now, that may seem like kind of a legalistic issue. It doesn't really strike pulling the heartstrings. Here's another example of regulatory invasiveness. It has to do with an expansion of the prosecution of environmental crimes. From 1983 to 1995, the Department of Justice indicted 406 corporate defendants and convicted 331 of them, but indicted 1,052 individuals and convicted 732 of them. From 1990 to 1995, the EPA's budget for prosecuting environmental crimes increased 400%. Much of this came from a law known as the Pollution Prosecutions Act of 1990. Now, sounds like it might be justifiable, and in many cases it probably is. But do you know what constitutes an environmental crime? If not, you certainly don't want to be a manager of a wastewater facility. Two individuals, Michael Weizenhoff and Thomas Mariani, were plant managers of a wastewater treatment facility in Honolulu. And over a period of 14 months, they exceeded their permit by discharging 6% more waste than allowed. They said they did so because they thought that avoiding a catastrophic failure of a waste treatment plant was authorized under their EPA permit. But in the court trial, they weren't permitted to testify to that effect. Nor did the EPA have to prove criminal intent. One of them was sentenced to 21 months in prison, the other was sentenced to 33 months. Now, farmers routinely spread not 6% of sewer sludge, but between one-half and one-third sewer sludge on their grounds, on their farmland, as fertilizer. Now, why do we get policies that are inefficient, ineffective, and invasive? Patrick Moore was on to something when he said that, "I believe there is a great deal to be learned by exploring the relationships between ecology and politics. In some ways, politics is the ecology of the human species." I think he's on the right track. Just to mend that, I'd say the root cause of environmental failure comes from people treating or not treating political, social, and economic systems as seriously as they treat ecological systems. Now, the Achilles heel of our typical approach to environmental policy, in my opinion, is that we tend to ignore the fact that our political ecology creates different groups working across purposes. That is, the incentives and constraints facing voters, politicians, bureaucrats, and special interest groups often act against achieving the common good. Constraints of time, energy, money, and knowledge, they all of those are virtually insurmountable for anyone to, you know. We often don't know what is the common good, let alone know how to achieve it, let alone have the incentive to push for it. Voters, for example, are often plagued by the problem of rational ignorance. It doesn't pay for voters to closely monitor everything that's going on. So what's often called voter apathy is actually rational decision to stay home. Politicians, of course, have incentives to do something, to appear to do something to solve a problem, and push problems onto other constituents or onto future generations. Government bureaucrats, of course, have incentives to find new problems. And special interest groups, their incentive often is to pull the wool over our eyes and come up with a great slogan and call it the public interest. Now, Robert Higgs, my co-editor, has an excellent book about the role of crisis in creating larger, less responsive government programs. Military and economic crises often lead to new programs that, after the crisis subsides, still have remnants there. The same is true with regard to environmental crises. Now, alternatives to environmental bureaucracy. What are we going to do about all this? We've got Michael and Randy to lay some of the details, but I want to just throw out a few broad principles. First, we want to try to look for low-hanging fruit. That is, policies that are politically easiest to achieve. In our earlier book, Cutting Green Tape, we point out that the largest source for the demand for toxic substances is the federal government, which immunizes itself and its contractors from liability. So that's something potentially changeable we need to go after if enough of us can get riled up. Second, you want to align incentives intelligently. For example, in Montana, public forests are managed both by state government and by the U.S. Forest Service. However, the outcome in their different management styles is tremendously different. For example, timber from state forests is sold for revenue for public schools. The forests in Montana that are managed by the feds is managed for the public interest. Now, guess which of these two groups of forests is demonstrably healthier? The one where there are stakeholders who really have a strong incentive to monitor the effectiveness of the program. So third, end destructive corporate subsidies that encourage misuse of land. Now, I'm trying to go from easier to harder. Fourth, look for less expensive ways to achieve environmental goals. Instead of command and control policies, employ market-based approaches that allow people to meet environmental goals at a lower cost. And also encourage innovation. We have a debate about this in chapters 19 and 20. Economists P.J. Hill and Roy Cordato, two economists taking opposing sides. Both of them have very good points to make. Another reason to buy the book. Cordato makes a good point that I shouldn't miss the opportunity to plug, and that is that even market-based proposals where the government sets a policy and industry has to follow it are often flawed because you still have politics involved in setting the priorities or setting the goals. And far superior, Cordato argues, is relying on stricter enforcement of private property rights, strict liability, the common law of trespass and nuisance, and price signals. Under the common law, a liability follows a demonstration of harm. Negligence rules may often be superior to rules emphasizing strict liability. Now, that's the direction we were going in the 1960s before the federalization of environmental policy. That door was really finally closed in 1981 in the Supreme Court case of Milwaukee versus Illinois. There, the Supreme Court decided that the common law couldn't be used to establish emission standards that were more stringent than those set by the Clean Water Act. So that for more information, you want to check out our earlier book, Cutting Green Tape. Now, fifth, How about encouraging a diversity of approaches by devolving environmental policy away from the federal level? I think that's the corollary of my earlier recommendation. Because only by experimentation can we discover a wide variety of ways to improve environmental quality. Now, 6, encourage environmental entrepreneurship. And this is where Michael and Randy come in. They'll provide some details on that. Now, I want to conclude by saying that to improve environmental policy, we need to have the same kind of sense of adventure, the same willingness to try new things and go new places that we saw in John McConnell when he was coming up with the idea for Earth Day, or that little kid who played in the gully. But we can only appreciate those approaches by ditching environmental bureaucracy and recognizing that all of us are part of nature and that our own processes, social, economic, and political, have held us back in the past. But if we understand how they operate and we rethink our institutions and reform them so that all of them tend to promote our goals of health and material abundance and a beautiful, healthy environment to enjoy as well, we'll all be better off. Okay, those are the general outlines, and I look forward to hearing Michael's presentation now.